This is Bill with another edition of What Makes Sense, featuring Biblical Citizenship from the Patriot Academy, wrapping up the final two sessions of the class. The subtitle of Week 7 is Religious Liberty and Protection of God-Given Rights. The purpose of government is to secure inalienable rights, which is the function of the Bill of Rights. Signer of the Constitution, John Dickinson, defined an inalienable right as a right which God gave to you and no inferior power has a right to take away. He wrote, "Human governments could not give the rights essential to happiness. We claim them from a higher source, from the King of Kings and Lord of all the earth. They are not annexed to us by parchments and seals. They are created in us by the decree of providence, which establish the laws of our nature. They are born with us, exist with us, and cannot be taken from us by any human power without taking our lives." Alexander Hamilton said it this way, "Inalienable rights are not to be rummaged for among old parchments or musty records. They are written, as with a sunbeam, in the whole volume of human nature by the hand of the divinity itself, and can never be erased or obscured by mortal power." Samuel Adams said that inalienable rights are imprinted by the finger of God on the hearts of men. John Adams said they are rights that cannot be repealed or restrained by human law, rights derived from the great legislator of the universe. The Noahide laws, the first earthly government established by God, were given to protect inalienable rights. Our nation has only fallen by one step. Our government has forgotten that there is a power higher than itself. This reality ought to be an inspiration for biblical Christians in that it is a recognition that the political realm is truly a spiritual one. The five fundamental freedoms in the First Amendment to the Constitution are press, speech, assembly, religion, and petition. Regarding religion, it says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Non-Christians emphasize the first part, that Congress and therefore government shall not establish religion. They interpret this to mean that the government shouldn't support religion in any way. But the First Amendment also says Congress should not prohibit the free exercise of religion. Taken in its totality, it says that Congress shall be neither for or against, but should be religion blind, just as it should be colorblind. There should be no discrimination whatsoever. Unfortunately, non-Christians are also religious and want their religious views supported. That's why the idea of separation of church and state was popularized in recent history. Where in the Constitution is the phrase separation of church and state? It is nowhere. Separation of church and state is literally unconstitutional. It brings us back to the intent of the Constitution's authors, to understand the intent of the legislators who pass any law. One must look at the journal where the discussions that took place at the time the law was being debated were recorded. Fortunately, the founders required such a journal. Article 1 of the Constitution, Section 5, requires that everything said on the floor of the House and Senate be recorded in a journal. How many times do the annals of Congress record the phrase separation of church and state during the debates drafting the First Amendment? None. Rather than being in the Constitution or even in the minds of its authors, the phrase appears in a different context in a letter from Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptists, assuring them that government would not infringe on their freedom of religion. Jefferson wasn't expressing an anti-religious sentiment. 2 days after writing the phrase separation of church and state, Thomas Jefferson attended the weekly church service held at the U.S. Capitol. These were religious services that he had helped to start and faithfully attended throughout the remainder of his presidency. What were the founders thinking when they crafted the First Amendment? James Madison said that the intent of the First Amendment was to prevent a single national denomination, like the Church of England. J. General Henry Knox and Secretary Charles Thompson both wrote in their journals about accidentally interrupting George Washington kneeling in prayer. What words are usually left out of Patrick Henry's famous speech by modern historians when he said, "Give me liberty or give me death"? He also said, "Forbid it, Almighty God." These were religious men, and they expressed religious sentiments. America was a decidedly Christian nation at its founding, and its leaders were Christian. Abraham Baldwin founded the University of Georgia and served as a chaplain in the Revolutionary War. Framers of the Constitution, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney and John Langdon, were founders of the American Bible Society. William Samuel Johnson quoted from the Book of Acts to challenge public school graduates to fulfill their duties to serve their Creator and country. Constitution framer James McHenry helped found the Maryland Bible Society. The most active and influential man of the Constitutional Convention and author of the preamble was Governor Morris. He wrote, "Religion is the only solid basis of good morals. Therefore, education should teach the precepts of religion and the duties of man toward God." The Northwest Ordinance required public schools to teach religion, morality, and knowledge. James Wilson signed both the Declaration and Constitution and served on the original Supreme Court. He said, "Human law must rest its authority ultimately upon the authority of that law which is divine. Far from being rivals or enemies, religion and law are twin sisters, friends, and mutual assistants. Indeed, these two sciences run into each other." The founders weren't just advocating an abstract freedom of worship divorced from politics. James Madison wrote, "If the First Amendment is reduced to freedom of worship instead of freedom of religion, there will be no protection of conscience anymore." George Washington said, "We should be very cautious of violating the rights of conscience in others, ever considering that God alone is the judge of the hearts of men, and to Him only are they accountable." Constitution signer William Livingston gave us this powerful testimony of how government must not discriminate against religion. "For what business, in the name of common sense, has the magistrate with our religion? The state does not have any concern in the matter. In what manner does it affect society, in what outward form we think it best to pay our adoration to God? The consciences of men are not the objects of human legislation. In contrast with this spiritual tyranny, how beautiful it appears our Constitution in disclaiming all jurisdiction over the souls of men, securing by a never-to-be-repealed section the voluntary, unchecked moral persuasion of every person by his own self, his directed communication with the Father of Spirits." America's first Supreme Court Justice, John Jay, concurred, "Security under any constitution is given to the rights of conscience and private judgment. They are by nature subject to no control but that of deity, and in that free situation they are now left." Starting in 1640, the top issue that brought people to America was the rights of conscience. The phrase, "the laws of nature and nature's God," comes from Blackstone's commentaries on the law. Blackstone taught that God revealed himself in nature and in his laws through the Holy Scriptures. As a consequence, the Bill of Rights prohibits government from violating inalienable rights and commands government to protect them. Here are a few concluding thoughts about other inalienable rights specified in the Bill of Rights. The Second Amendment guarantees the right to bear arms. As Declaration signer John Adams said, "Resistance to sudden violence for the preservation not only of my person, my limbs, and life, but of my property, is an indisputable right of nature which I never surrendered to the public life by the compact of society, in which perhaps I could not surrender if I would. The maxims of law and the precepts of Christianity are precisely coincident, in agreement, in relation to this subject." Declaration signer Richard Henry made it clear that there is a political intent in the Second Amendment, saying, To preserve liberty, it is essential that the whole body of the people always possess arms, and be taught alike, especially when young, how to use them. Is the Constitution racist because it didn't abolish slavery? Delegates from the northern states wanted it so. George Mason did not sign the Constitution because it did not end slavery, and because he wanted more boundaries placed around government. However, the failure to abolish slavery must be seen in context. The founders wrote the Constitution to accommodate 13 independent states, and needed to emphasize uniting principles. They felt that they needed to leave slavery for another day. The good news is that Americans eventually got it right, at great cost in the Civil War. Here's an example of how modern interpretations of the Constitutions have undermined original intent. The Supreme Court changed the eminent domain clause in the Constitution from public use to public purpose, which makes it easier to take private property. It allowed government to take private property for uses other than public to serve everyone. Now the use can be anything that abstractly has a public benefit, such as one that generates tax revenue. The founders clearly thought differently about private property. James Madison wrote, "Government is instituted to protect property. This being the end of government, that alone is a just government which impartially secures to every man whatever is his own. It is not a just government, nor is property secure under it, where arbitrary restrictions deny to part of its citizens that free use of their facilities, or where the property which a man has in his personal safety and personal liberty is violated by arbitrary seizures of one class of citizens for the service of the rest." In other words, government must create laws that apply to everyone equally. That was the guiding principle. The final segment of biblical citizenship is entitled Being Salt and Light, and here we get to consider what we ought to do about it. Politics and religion share this in common. In both areas, there is seldom anything we could refer to as resolution. It is understandable in the area of faith because our walk with the Lord is a process, an overcoming of the nature of sin. Furthermore, that overcoming of sin doesn't change the nature of the world's people and their problems. Politicians promise to address worldly problems, but politics simply draws us back to the conflict in men's hearts, because citizens aren't united in their understanding of righteousness and justice. Christians are called to represent the righteousness of God, so we have to accept that role in our exercise of political freedom, trusting the Lord that He will fulfill our duty to be His ambassadors. With that in mind, here are some examples of actions we might take. Our group got excited about a simple project of Patriot Academy founder Rick Green when he was serving in the Texas State Legislature. Texas passed a law requiring schools to celebrate the anniversary of the U.S. Constitution by teaching about the Constitution every September 17th. What Texas was addressing was the apparent failure of public schools to educate children about the Constitution and its safeguards to protect the freedoms of Americans. The evidence suggested that American schoolchildren were rejecting American exceptionalism and embracing socialism as an alternative. Critical race theory and the 1619 Project are recent examples of how the educational establishment emphasizes the negative events of our history rather than the unifying knowledge that Americans have always been on a trajectory of self-correction and increasing justice. The celebration of a Constitution Day seemed to us like a simple measure to implement in our local school, especially since we learned there was also a federal law stipulating that observation. We were also advised that 90% of public schools do not do it, and we thought this might be an easy win. The reality is, it might get complicated. Missouri law already requires that every student must pass a test on the Constitution, and our school already has a curriculum geared to passing the test. What is the curriculum? Why isn't it producing patriotic graduates who love and support American principles? Is it a single day of celebration enough to overcome the seemingly pervasive teaching about our socio-political failings? In spite of all these reservations, you can be an ambassador for the Constitution in your local school district while recognizing there may not be a quick fix. We need to start applying the principle of incrementalism as we work to bring America back to her roots. The principle is that baby steps implemented consistently over time can restore the nation. Beyond special projects, we need to implement lifelong participation in the system created by the framers of our Constitution. Articles 1 and 2 describe the legislative and executive branches of government and how they are elected. Our responsibility as American citizens is to vote. The first place in the Constitution a citizen is given responsibility is the word chosen in Article 1, Section 2. In a populous nation, it's easy to think your individual vote doesn't matter, but here are a couple of examples. Rick Green lost his first race by only 20 votes out of 30,000, and then won the election by 36 votes after a recount. Furthermore, the 2000 presidential election was determined by a mere 537 votes in Florida. The myth that your vote doesn't matter was probably started by someone who didn't want you to vote. Evil abounds in a nation when those who vote for righteousness are discouraged from doing so. Noah Webster once wrote, "Let it be impressed in your mind that God commands you to choose for rulers just men who will rule in the fear of God. If the citizens neglect their duty and place unprincipled men in office, the government will soon be corrupted. If our government fails to secure public prosperity and happiness, it must be because the citizens neglect the divine commands and elect bad men to make and administer the laws." The right to choose our leaders is something most people in the history of the world never got to do. Exercise that right. Proverbs 29:2 says, "When the righteous rule, the people rejoice. When the wicked rule, the people groan." Patriot Academy refers to the mixing bowl of the American system, the container that holds the ingredients of citizen participation. Ours is a government of the people, so we have to understand our role in making our government a just one. There are three components. First is our responsibility to have knowledge. I became convinced several years ago that we had to understand the platforms of candidates for office, and it was a very revealing process. I found that many candidates never communicated clear ideas or proposed solutions. Their websites were full of slogans like, "A true conservative," "I support the Second Amendment," "pro-life," or "native Missourian." These are nice sentiments, but they leave you with unanswered questions of what will the candidates do to make a difference. However, there's another kind of knowledge we need, which is, by what standard will we evaluate the candidate's platform? Before we can choose wisely at the polls, we must know the principles by which to measure the candidate. The answer from this course is to understand America's founding principles in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. These are the principles and practices which have made America succeed in terms of social fairness, prosperity, and freedom. It is the standard by which we judge a candidate. If a candidate says they will increase your pay, be skeptical, because that's not the role of government. The second ingredient is related to the first. Rather than merely accept the pool of candidates given to you, you should help determine who your candidates will be. Find good people with leadership skills and ask them to run. By good people, we mean the ones whose ideas reflect the standard in the first principle. The third ingredient is actions of the citizens. It's not my personal favorite, but you can impact the political process by knocking on doors, making phone calls, contributing, etc. This seems to me a lot like annoying people into doing the right thing when they really should be internally motivated to do steps 1 and 2 above. But I'm wrong on the practical front. American elections are ultimately about getting more votes than the other candidate. So you need to get out voters any way you can. We should never let the motivated few dominate, because that can leave the process up to those who have an agenda. The Bible tells us to spur one another on toward love and good works. The busy work of political activism is an example of the biblical mandate to spur one another on. Keep in mind that a politician is only thinking about the next election. A patriot, a biblical citizen, is concerned about the next generation. There are a couple of other ways to participate which we don't often think about. Article 3 of the Constitution describes the judiciary branch of government, and we usually think choosing judges isn't in our control. However, we can try to influence who the senators are who approve justices through our voting for senators. But regardless of who wins the election of becoming a senator, we can contact them whenever a judicial selection is forthcoming to encourage our senator to consider the record of judicial candidates. You also have every right to get involved with the state judiciary by expressing your recommendations whenever a concerning decision is being considered. Finally, support legal organizations like the Liberty Council, First Liberty Institute, the Alliance Defending Freedom, ACLJ, Pacific Justice Institute, etc. These organizations are watchdogs over the judiciary and may represent your principles more effectively than you can. Remember that judges are not as accountable to voters as either Congress or the President, so you must influence their decisions through whatever means you can find. Article 4 of the Constitution contains several seemingly random instructions, but an important underlying principle is that America is a republic and not a democracy. Educate everyone you know about this important truth. One of the distinctions between Republicans and Democrats that usually goes unmentioned is that Republicans strive to preserve representative government, whereas Democrats want to convert us into a democracy ruled by majority vote. Although majority vote seems like giving power to the people, it's not the constitutional model. A republic recognizes that citizens are too busy to understand all the issues of government and should therefore elect representatives to thoroughly research and decide most issues. Those representatives are then held accountable for their decisions at election time. You might understand it best as a kind of remote control democratic process through which elected experts perform the people's will most of the time, but can be voted out if they fail to represent rightly. Democrats want to break this model because it's easier to manipulate public opinion than it is to fool an expert. If that criticism sounds partisan, it's not meant to be. It is simply a reasonable critique of the party's political strategy. We saw the contrast recently in the Missouri legislature, where Republicans tried to change the rules for amendment initiatives to make it harder to change the state constitution. They were defeated because Democrats wanted to continue the bare majority standard to change the Constitution because it would be easier for voters to bypass their elected representatives. Citizens can also participate in constitutional government by adopting a potential amendment to the Constitution as your project. Most of the amendments to the U.S. Constitution began as an idea among citizens, which became viable ideas once enough citizens supported it. One such idea might be a balanced budget amendment. I would think that a well-crafted balanced budget requirement could have universal appeal that might spread among citizens in every state. Rather than force a partisan principle, it reflects the universal idea to pay as you go instead of increasing debt. If you want to join an existing movement to amend the Constitution, join the Convention of States movement at conventionofstates.com. Article 5 of the Constitution prescribes a way for states to propose amendments. A democracy runs on passion, a republic runs on reason. The amendment process is designed to be slow to keep passion out of it. The Founding Fathers designed the amendment process so that if an amendment passes, it is because the people themselves supported it. Article 5 gives two options for how to amend the Constitution. The first option is for Congress to propose an amendment. When two-thirds of both House and Senate adopt proposed amendments, they are sent to the states for ratification, and 3/4 of the states must ratify for the amendment to become part of the Constitution. The second option is for state legislatures to call for a meeting of representatives from all of the states. When 2/3 of the states apply, Congress must call a convention of the states for proposing amendments. Any amendments proposed at the convention must still be ratified by 3/4 of the states before the amendment would become part of the Constitution. It does not endanger the Constitution to use the Constitution. There's no risk of throwing out the existing Constitution because Article 5 limits changes to this Constitution. Furthermore, states can recall their delegates to the Convention of States if the delegates do not honor the wishes of their respective states. A convention of states is a way for the states to push back against encroachment by the federal government. Citizens should also keep up with proposed treaties. Agreements with other nations constitutionally belong to the federal government, but can affect the freedoms of Americans. International agreements about climate change, firearms regulation, and others can at least influence your rights. Don't allow foreign governments to dictate our laws. Live the Bill of Rights. We saw this recently when our own Camden County Commission at Lake of the Ozarks refused a request from the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau for business registration information. The commission affirmed that the Second Amendment forbids Congress from infringing on the rights of citizens to bear arms. So the ATF has no constitutional authority. In doing so, the commission put the ball back in the Fed's court, challenging them to either stand down or violate their own rules. Be the press. Technology, while sometimes cursed, is also a gift, for it allows godly people to have a reach far beyond their immediate circle of friends. You can blog or vlog or post on a myriad of social media platforms, or even create your own website or radio or TV channel. Use these means to be independent journalists, to positively influence your friends, acquaintances, and even the nation. Jesus told us we would do greater things than him. Whereas he spoke a sermon on a mount, we have access to the world as his ambassadors. We must never forget that the political conflict in our country has spiritual roots that demand Christians to be involved. With all the talk about politics and constitutional details, it's easy to forget that the primary message is that our nation is lost if godly people allow it to be so by not becoming influencers. I am not talking about something abstract. It is individual people who are harmed by the overreaching power grab of national politicians. Christians are called to save the lost and disciple them to follow Christ. Let's put Christ back in Christianity. Reverend Matthias Burnett said it this way, "Finally, ye, whose power it is to save or destroy your country, consider well the important trust which God has put into your hands. To God and posterity, you are accountable for them. Let not your children have reason to curse you for giving up those rights and prostrating those institutions which your fathers delivered to you. And remember also that you are safe in God's will, for duty is ours, but results are His." Thanks for joining us today. Until next time, go out and do good.